Time for another Zoomer on the Midweek Drive for Siren Radio and southsidebroadcasting.podbeam.com. Keeping the COVID-19 bugs at bay.
The lift shift was the office equivalent of a dunce's cap. It meant for that day and the following, Marley would be summoned to deal with the helpless and the hopeless who advanced on the back lodge with the mistaken assumption that a story in the Gazette would magically bring peace and justice to their dysfunctional lives. Edwards held out his phone. First customer. Apparently, he has the unlikely, yet promising, name of Mr. Saint. Are we referring to the Roger Moore and Ian Ogilvy classic of the 1960s and 70s? No, but we are referring to Marley's Weapon, only the latest epic version and indeed text of Ian Lennox, creator extraordinaire. Ian, welcome to the Midweek Drive. How are you, sir?
Thank you very much. I'm very well, thank you.
And this makes such a change because normally, of course, in the traditional form, when, of course, we weren't sort of dealing with pandemics and getting the latest kind of updates in one way, shape or form, we would have actually been talking about this doubtless on a Thursday morning. We might still be because, again, Priest will be going out on Thursday and so on. But you're on the evening slot to actually talk about this tremendous thing. And it's happened, partly written in Spain, partly written in Britain. We're going to talk about it in a few moments, but I need to welcome the team formally. We have, as mentioned, from North Carolina, the one and only Jessica Burtis. How are you, Jessica?
Hello, good.
Fantastic. And Steve Court, SC, returns to the Midweek Drive. How are you, Steve Court?
Very well, thank you. It's nice to be back.
Yeah, well, you know, as I say, that's one of the beautiful things about Zoom. And Steve, do not worry, because Jessica actually spent at least 7 weeks just literally with white digits on a black background before she finally realised, oh, if I press this button here, I can have vision. And it's okay. We don't have to worry about that. Ian, astonishingly, managed to get it pretty much.
Sounds like a fellow traveller to me.
Exactly. But as I say, it is radio, so let's not worry about it. It's the audio we're concerned about. Ian, yes. Talk to us about Marley's Weapon.
Gosh, when I decided I was going to write a book, I had to decide what year I was going to set it in, and I wanted to write about a newspaper office where a guy was bullied. When I was on one of the national papers in the 60s, there's a lad there who was very quiet. He came from somewhere like Dorset, and he didn't really fit in with the Manchester crowd. And people didn't really bother with him. But he was quite a pleasant chap, but completely unaggressive. And one day he announced that his wife had left him, and not long after that he left, and no one seemed hardly noticed he'd gone. And I felt how sad no one took any notice of him at all. He didn't fit in. So I thought, I wanted to write about a character suffering that sort of ostracized sort of existence. So I chose, I didn't know whether to choose a television background or a newspaper background, because I've had big experience of both of those. But I decided I would go for a newspaper background, because I'd actually worked in the 60s in newspapers. And I sort of laid a lot of my experience in newspapers into the book, actually. And that's how it came about. And I went off to Spain because I just thought, well, I really do need to get started on this, and the way to sort of give myself a impetus, I just went off my own for a month and just started to write it. And I wrote about 12,000-15,000 words out there in the first draft, and it continued from there when I got back.
And it is pretty awesome. I'll give a little précis in the About This Book section. It's the 60s, 1960s, by the way, in case you're thinking. I know Ian's quite chronologically gifted, but surely even he wouldn't go back to the 1860s. No, the 1960s. And newspapers are still enjoying a boom. Young reporters knock on doors and dream of careers on the nationals. Noel Marley isn't one of them. He seems content to be one of life's losers and endures the sneers and sniggers of his ambitious colleagues. Then one day, one of the alpha males humiliates him gratuitously in front of the whole office, and he decides to fight back. His choice of weapon is a clattering old typewriter that sounds like a machine gun. Marley's Weapon doesn't use bullets, just words. Jessica, a typewriter was something that used to be used frequently by writers to actually punch things out. It was quite a wonderful thing, a bit like a keyboard, except a lot noisier. I know, it's great stuff. Sorry. Jessica, any questions you'd like to put to Ian? Because I know you're a regular in terms of our author series, and obviously you're a creative writing student as well, for that point of view, over in North Carolina. So would you like to start off the quiz questioning, please, Jessica?
I would actually ask how you kind of incorporated your background in journalism into this story, because I know it's set in a newsroom, and is it kind of Marley uses the articles that he writes to kind of fight back?
Yes, what happens is that his opponent, a chap called John Dury, is the alpha male of the office, and he writes controversial reviews and features. And what Marley does, writes letters to the paper criticising the reviews and his writing, and then so battle commences. But it becomes rapidly apparent that, in fact, lowly though Marley's position is in the office, he's a far better writer than Drury. And he tears them to pieces. There's quite a few instances, but the best one is where Marley writes about Mozart. Drury writes about Mozart and saying one of his fugues was played too slowly for his taste. And Drury points out that Mozart, in fact, in his notes, asked them that the fugue was played slowly, and it went on from there. You know, and this all came from one of my uncles was a concert pianist. And he asked me once about a very famous columnist in the 60s who worked in national newspapers. And he asked me what I thought of him. And I said, I think he's a bit dangerous because he seems to write authoritatively about things he knows little about. And he started to laugh. And he says he commits schoolboy howlers. And he told him this story about Mozart. So that's where I got it from. And anyway, as the thing progresses, Marley eventually had been writing under a pseudonym, a nom de plume of Cyclops, reveals his true identity, and all hell breaks loose, of course, in the office. And there's a huge row develops. And the editor backs Marley, because Marley didn't criticize him personally. He criticized the reviews, the work. And it goes on from there about what happens to his life after that. Basically he gets promoted to doing features, which he's good at. He finds the first time in his life he likes doing something, and it goes on from there. There's all these sort of adventures that happen, and how his life develops. So it's it's an interesting experience for me, because I actually worked in a newspaper office in the 60s. And it was interesting to revisit a lot of the situations that I'd never thought about for years. For instance, in my newspaper office in the 60s, there were a lot of people in the 50s and 60s who fought in the war. And there was one day, a party of Japanese came around the office, and one of the senior people in the office got up and went snarling and swearing into the library, locked the door, and wouldn't come out until they'd gone. And it turned out he'd been a prisoner of the war, the Japanese. And we just passed, and at the time, we almost made a joke of it. And when I went and revisited the situation, right, I was appalled, because I realised what he'd gone through. He'd seen things we never could imagine, you know, today. And I felt rather ashamed of myself, actually. And it was, because I was going back in time like this, I found it really interesting to sort of examine my... the septuagenarian I was today, looking back at the same things as when I was in my 20s, and how different a person I was, you know. Mm-hmm. So it was quite an interesting experience for me in that respect.
Yeah, Ian, 50 years, it just goes like that. It's meaningless, really. I mean, you know, look at Steve Court, 173, still not out. He's still sort of, you know, clocking up the whole thing.
Be boycott.
Exactly. Steve, you've had a listen to that. Is this something which you are tempted to say, I'm going to spend 99 English pennies to get this right now from Kindle and Amazon for Marley's Weapon? Or is it a case of, no, anything got pennies. Newspapers in it, I step away from?
99 pennies. that's all.
Yeah.
I tell you what, that's that good. And you've intrigued me that much that while we're on this chat, I'm going to buy it from Amazon.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Outrageous.
I was looking at the sales figures. It's only out for a day or two, and it's up to an under 17,000th bestseller, but there's millions of the blim things on Kindle. But it's really misleading, because I'm sure a lot of them haven't moved for years. You know, they've been lying for 20 years. Not sold
Ian, good PR. Just leave the misleading things to one side, you know. Mm-hmm. Learn from Dominic Cummings, okay? Just ignore it, okay? Just step over to life with the whole thing. Steve, any questions you've got for Ian?
Yeah, I mean, my question's more about kind of a writer's process, because you've got quite a obviously an in-depth backstory that's going on there with all of your own personal experiences.
Yes.
How did you take not just telling your own story and adapting that as a writer? How did you then adapt that onto your character?
Well, the first principle I always adhere to when I'm writing a book is to know the time and the place and the people and the customs of the novel I'm setting, the setting of the novel, because if I don't do that, I'm dead. It's hopeless. And I started with that idea I explained before about the chap on the national paper who just didn't fit in, and it just basically developed from there. There seemed to be there was a logical progression, and I used obviously a lot some of the things that did actually happen to me when I was a young reporter. We used to go down to what was called the Back Lodge. And on one day, I won't name the name of the pop group, but as a chap came in and he said to me, I'm managing this group and they're going to be in the top 20 next week. And I said, well, how do you know that? And he said, we know the shops where the trade papers go to estimate the sales of the books of the books of the records, and what we do is we buy quantities of those shops, and sure enough, this book was in the top 20 in the 2 or 3 days hence, and so I use that sort of little knowledge things like that. And of course, I also, having been a reporter, I knew quite a lot of people who had been in the periphery of the pop world, and I rang them up and asked them about things, and they told me about more detail. So that I use that in the first chapter of the book, and how he meets this world-famous pop star, man who becomes a world-famous pop star. And they get on and become friends, actually. And I used him as a sort of peripheral character, really. But they come to good friends, but I also sort of make little commentaries on fame. When Matty, the pop star, becomes world famous, he comes back to Newcastle, but he only comes back to in ragweed, because he can dress up as a mandarin or a pirate or something like that, and he's not recognised. And it's a huge luxury for him to go out into the streets and not be pursued by people. So I was making little commentaries like that on the sort of misconception of fame, because I was rather alarmed when I was a journalist to find that the survey was done, and up to 40% of young people, I think, were asked their ambitions, and they said to be famous. And because I was a journalist, in television especially, I saw the effects of fame on a lot of people, and it was something I just certainly didn't want to be.
Let's just test that, Ian. Jessica, as a young person, I mean, clearly you're already famous because you're on the Midweek Drive on a regular basis.
Oh, yes, of course.
Literally going to rob a bank there.
Yeah, it's called being socially responsible, Ian, okay? You might be in your house, the scarf is supposed to be over the mouth, you know? Jessica is demonstrating to us, you know, the right way forward. I could actually use my teaching sort of zone, which is, of course, the official visor, which we need to use. I shan't, okay? So that's the key thing. This is the new important thing when we're in a socially conscious sort of way. Or maybe we're all just being suckered into this. I don't know. But let's not face £10,000 fines. Anyway, question is, Jessica, that fame thing, how do you find with your peers? I mean, is that something in North Carolina that people say, yeah, I'm a young person, I just want to be famous, like Donald Trump?
Oh, I don't know about that. I think most people, I think we have kind of an idealized version of what fame is. I think a lot of us are like, oh, it would be so cool to just be able to travel, you know, or have the ease of life that we kind of think that celebrities do. But the more I think about it, I realize that I think that so many celebrities just don't have the chance to do normal things. They kind of like in movies we'll see like, oh, the, you know, the high schoolers at like the parties and everything, and you know, we're like, oh, you know, why can't we do that? But the people who are famous now from that didn't even get a chance to experience what they're acting
and won't
out
now, obviously, because of COVID-19, so you know, it's
of
tough.
Course
So. Step away from that. Steve, as a teacher, because I mean, you're a drama teacher as well as obviously a fine writer to boot. But I mean, the kids that you've taught, etc., are they sort of secretly harboring, you know, they want to be Lincoln's next big thing?
Oh, forget Lincoln. Everybody believes they're the world's next big thing. I teach classes of students. It made me think of it when you asked the question to Jessica a minute ago about a class that I once asked what they wanted to be. We were talking about careers and future career prospects, and probably 25 out of 30 kids in the class said they were just going to be famous. And when I then asked those 25 kids what their talent was, no one could really back that up. No one really had an answer to that question. They didn't particularly have a thing they felt they were very good at. They were just going to be famous. And I think that's where we've gone in the world now with social media and with reality TV shows, is you can be famous for being famous now. And that's it. And that's all they want. They just want the acclaim, the supposed amount of money that comes with that, like Jess said about traveling the world and doing all these things. But I don't think people realize that fame isn't particularly fame anymore. It's more notoriety. And every time you're famous, you just have a world of people looking for the opportunity to tear you down.
Particularly with respect to the negative side of social media as well. I mean, I was doing a piece earlier today with a couple of television builders who I suspect haven't actually crossed over to the Atlantic as yet. And I have to say, I was informed that they were television's best known builder and plasterer, Julian Perryman and Chris Frediani. I never heard of them at all, basically. But at the same, I mean, Ian, are you aware of these two guys?
No.
Well, that's right. Steve, I mean, if I said Julian Perryman and Chris Frediani, television's best-known builder and plasterer, would you have said, wow, you know, that's mega. That's almost like getting, you know, I don't know, Her Majesty the Queen on.
It's in line. It's almost Shwaddy-waddy level, isn't it?
Anyway, their key thing was basically how to actually deal with unfair stereotypes damaging our local tradespeople, and again, using social media to effectively diswork that effectively gets the stereotype that all builders are cowboys. I can't believe that. You know, I know. It's just outrageous.
Just American ones.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, just so, not actual cowboys. Yeah.
Not actually. Well, I hope not. I mean, otherwise we're into a whole range of things. But the findings of this particular survey, apparently the most common negative misconceptions about tradespeople, famous or otherwise, are they're too expensive, unreliable, rip-off merchants, cowboys, untrustworthy, unprofessional, untidy, they never show up, they're always late, and indeed they're pushy.
It's quite scathing.
Are we saying that's not true?
Unfortunately, you'll be able to hear the views of both those guys because it'll be following this little piece, actually. So stay with us, dear listener, and you too will be able to actually have an insight into television's best-known builder and plasterer, Julian Perryman and Chris Frediani. It carries on. Let's move on. Ian, have you got any questions you want to put wearing your journalistic hat, you know, speaking as one of the interviewers behind such luminaries as Catherine Cookson, amongst others, Jessica Burtis, about living life back in North Carolina now, back in that land, which I think they're having some kind of election. I think there was a bit of a debate
that was going on
yesterday. Yeah, no, this is a shocker. I mean, I think even the Commander-in-Chief, Potos, doesn't actually believe there's going to be an election, but that's by the by, you know. What's the Constitution? any questions about Jessica or Steve?
Yeah. I just wonder if the Americans realise that how much they've gone down in the estimation of the European world because of the antics of Donald Trump since he became president. That's debate last night was quite simply just a disgrace. It wasn't a debate; it was just a deliberate shouting match. The man in charge.
Don't say
debate.
Smart. Don't say smart. Do not say smart. Do not say smart.
Yeah.
There are strict rules for these events, and they weren't followed last night. Mm-hmm. Trump just wrecked, he just vandalized the whole thing. I suspect what could happen. There's two more debates, I think. They will lay down the rules and cut the microphones off if they start that nonsense again. It can't have done any good at all. I mean, I heard comments even in America about people who watched it, and they were appalled as well.
Jessica, what were your thoughts on the whole debate system? Did you watch it yourself?
I actually was not able to watch it, so I had to go back this morning to see it. But basically, I think Americans were all just as frustrated and confused by it. Everyone's kind of been joking that the moderator was like a kindergarten teacher trying to control little kids. And I was telling my roommate, I was like, this is like watching people arguing over Thanksgiving dinner. This isn't a debate at all. It's absolutely ridiculous. But I think it's such a sad thing to say, but I think we had all expected it to be like that. And for it to just kind of be a source of entertainment.
The point is, though, that those debates are governed by very strict rules. Mm-hmm. And he just broke the law. He broke everything. And I heard they actually put I think it was CNN, put a fact check on. And they said that Trump hardly said a sentence without some inaccuracy in it. It was just extraordinary what he's getting away with.
Yeah, it's very sad to see. And I don't think a lot of people had faith that either one was going to be making very succinct points about their platforms, but I think it turned out worse than we thought.
Well, I think Biden came through better only because he became a lot tougher than people expected him to be. I mean, he did stand up. People thought he was going to get hit by an avalanche, I think, and he did stand up for it. He obviously despises Trump. And it was a very, very unhealthy experience, so I thought.
Well, as I said early on another program, actually, if you want to see Joe Biden at his best, Parks and Recreation, Season 5, he makes a personalized appearance in this. And if you can't have Leslie Knope as president, the fictional character of Amy Poehler, then Joe Biden should be okay, obviously, working with Kamala Harris. Of course, Steve, in England, I refuse to actually include the other parts of the United Kingdom because actually I don't think Boris really wants them. We have our own little chap who was actually on air earlier today, if you listen to this, say, as soon as the podcast has actually dropped, with a certain BJ. I mean, are you enthused by the man, or do you think, again, what is he saying, or is it just a case of we're doomed? Steve?
What? I felt safe while we were talking about Trump because I think we can point fingers over the other side of the pond and say whatever we like, but I have to be very careful not to get too hot-headed when we talk about the lovely Mr. Bojo.
Don't go back to work. Stay here. Oh, I don't know. We're all doing very well.
It's crystal clear. I mean, basically, we should stay in unless we have to go out. But if we go out, we should stay in. We must remain alert, looking for this, you know, this tiny microbe that's impossible to see. We've got to stay alert. I'm like, well, if I'm in the park with seven people, what am I supposed to do? Keep an eye out and hide behind a tree if it comes along or something? I don't quite understand what it is we're being asked to do.
Here are Thursday's rules.
Yeah. All pubs need to close by 10, but not the pubs that I want to drink in. Yes. He says, you know, as he keeps open. Although I think he's gone back on that now, hasn't he?
There was consternation apparently when they all discovered that the House of Commons bar was going to close at 10 o'clock as well.
that stays open because the coronavirus isn't interested in MPs. It only actually sort of likes to wait hide until 10 o'clock and then burst out.
There's a lot of people think the coronavirus could do a lot of good if they attack the MPs.
Steve.
I was going to say, I coach my son's Sunday League team, and the irony is Sunday League football can still happen, and we have no restrictions on how many parents or supporters can come to watch the game. So at 10:30 on a Sunday morning, you can find myself and another coach, along with 30 players and 40 parents, all stood in the same park watching it for an hour and a half. But after that hour and a half finishes, a minute later, we would all be breaking the law because we're now more than a group of six in a park in a gathering of more than 30
people. Yes, yes.
And just bear in mind, Steve, that it's only a matter of time before the army are brought in to actually deal with the admin work.
You're shooting my goalkeeper. That's what you have to do. Yeah. It's like, but you know, you can't have seven kids in the park feeding the ducks, but you can have 30 people in the park shooting the ducks.
Hmm. Yep, as well, I say, back to parks and recreation. I think I've discovered the underlying message that Michael Schur, before he actually started developing The Good Place and Upload, this was what it was all about, parks and recreation.
I think you'll add about 50, providing you can afford a shotgun, go on shooting birds.
Yeah, once again, a political comment there, potentially, Ian, and I'm not going to rise to that bait. You know, we've got a license to maintain, we've got Ofcom, we're not talk radio. You want to go down that line? Listen to Peter Hitchens. It's a whole new world. Jessica, any sort of clue? I mean, again, just describe actually how you're coping over there, because presumably, are you speaking to us from your flat? Or again, explain where you're contacting us from.
Yes, I'm sitting in the lobby of my dorm right now. So we have the outside of my campus right here. It's a very nice day, very sunny.
And obviously, we're gearing up at Lincoln for a return. To the whole sort of system. I was on campus this week. We have an online welcome week, and then it's full on blended learning, and we will see what we shall see. I mean, again, how are you finding this as a student? Because I mean, I've been saying to my students, obviously, I you were one of my students. You've gone back to the States now, so frankly, we don't care anymore. No, that's not. Oh, but in terms of that whole sort of sequence, what's the reaction of the students to the tutors that you've got in your university?
I think that we understand that they're struggling with the online format just as much as we are. I think that for us students, it doesn't really feel like school. It kind of feels like sleepaway camp. It's like we just roll out of bed 2 minutes before class and like flop down in front of our computers and like hit the record button. And people are texting during class and stuff. It's very bizarre. It's just, it's not quite the same.
You see, I mean, there is that illusion that we still actually host, and I'm sure Steve will actually maintain this, that as an academic delivering material online, everyone is actually gripped, you know, passionately to the screen, listening to every single syllable, but every single syllable that's actually uttered. I'm sure that's the case with you, Steve. I'm not sure about myself.
Well, I love this. I love this new setup. I've delivered a few creative writing classes to some of the... I run a charity project for young students after school once a week. And that's obviously had to stop when the schools close and everything like that. But we carried on running a few workshops online. And I loved the fact that we had the teaching was still happening the same as it would do. I could see all their little faces across the top of the screen, which was odd, but I could still see them. They could see me. We were talking, we were interacting. But down the side of the screen was the text, like the chat option. And all the students were still chatting in there. But I know that they've all recorded the screens. Unlike in the past, where I'm teaching a class to students, I can see them switched off. I can see them just thinking about what they're going to do in 10 minutes at break time, and I know aren't listening to me. I know, worst case, they've recorded it, and they can always go back and listen to what it was I taught them later on. And when they were in the chat down the side of the screen, they were getting out of their system that wanting to arrange what time they were going to meet later or what they were going to have for their tea. But they were still engaging in doing the work while we were doing it. And I actually thought it was a brilliant blend of both that you can't get in a classroom.
So there we are, you see, once again, Steve gives us that little shaft of light, that shaft of optimism, which also proves that even in the case of the midweek drive, who would have thought, you know, a year ago, even several months ago, we would have all been able to actually sort of share this experience of actually sharing to see the letters STEVECAWTE. Wonderful. It's great. It's what it's all about. I think it's just moved there. And coming up next, after a little tribute to the late, great Helen Reddy, we've got Julian Perryman and Chris Frediani, of course, TV's best known builder and plasterer. However, Jessica, would you like to put those last two questions to Steve and Ian, please?
Yes. Ian and Steve, have you both had a reasonably interesting Zoomer link with us today?
Yes, I have. Thank you.
Yes, I have. Yes.
Fantastic.
Excellent. They're like trained. It's wonderful. The response was just superb. It's excellent. Next one.
And will you be joining us again?
I hope so.
If you'll have me.
Exactly.
It's all again, no overlap. We should be playing tennis, you see. In doubles.
Marley's Weapon, Ian Lennox, is out and available now. I'm sure Steve will have a review by the time you actually join us again. Ian, you're coming back shortly. Jessica, you're back as well with us, presumably. Tomorrow,
yes,
I think.
I muted myself. Yes, I will.
And somehow, holding the microphone and pressing the unmute button, it's very confusing. I know, I've had difficulty. It's great. You know, we get there in the end. And Steve, likewise, will be back with us before too long in this whole brave new Zoom age. Ian Lennox, Steve Court, and Jessica Burtis, huge thanks and stay safe.
Bye. Thank you.
Bye.
Too expensive, unreliable, rip-off merchants, cowboys, untrustworthy, some of the top lists in terms of negative misconceptions people actually have about tradespeople. So to put this to rights and to actually address this recent survey that was put together by Checkatrade, we're absolutely delighted to welcome two fantastic individuals. In fact, it's fair to say they are indeed television's best-known builder and plasterer, the tremendous Julian Perryman and Chris Frediani. How are you, Julian? How are you, Chris?
Very well, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Marvellous. Now, Julian, talk us through this particular aspect, which does suggest that an awful lot of those stereotypes still resonate with people in terms of, you know, you can't almost say the word builder without saying, is it a cowboy builder?
Yes, unfortunately, you know, there have been the odd, you know, there's been TV programmes around that have shown builders in bad lights, and it just tends to stick in people's memory. You know, don't get me wrong, there are still, you know, bad builders out there, but you know, like I say, we work on DIY SOS, and we've been lucky enough to work with thousands and thousands of builders over the last 21 years, and we just don't think it's fair now that builders are still held in that bad light.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, just talk us through some of those top misconceptions that people have. You know, we started off by saying, is it too expensive, unreliable? Obviously, again, there are horror stories out there, but they are very much in the minority, aren't they?
Go on, Chris.
Oh, yeah, no, they are. I mean, you know, the word untrustworthy, unprofessional, untidy, never show up. I mean, these are old naming of general builders, you know. The way we see it, it's the last 20 years, people that have gone into training, people have gone taking themselves to colleges. There's a lot of brilliant young, middle-aged, top general builders, decorators, plasterers, painters, electricians, and they, you know, this one bad word, cowboys, is being very disrespectful, and it's very negative of the UK tradespeople that are out there. There's some terrific trades out there.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that's always going to cause problems is prejudgment or indeed prejudice. And that whole notion of any system which suffers from prejudice is going to have problems and challenges. However, there are ways in which people can actually ensure that if they're not getting your good selves to work on the job, that the tradespeople that they are actually booking are indeed reliable. I mean, talk us through the best way in which people can actually stick to the reputable and vetted tradespeople.
Well, obviously, there's the old rule of thumb, reputation. Ask someone that's had a builder, plasterer, you know, whatever tradesperson in their house, and word of mouth, recommendation. But if you've moved into an area and you don't know anyone or you've got no one to compare, then just click on to checkatrade.com and they would have done the vetting for you. There's 12 crucial checks they put you through, their skills, their reliability, and most importantly, their trustworthiness. You must have trust that works both ways between the client and the tradesperson.
Yeah, it's a very much a trust-based scenario. Julian, were you surprised by these findings?
Yes, I was, because like you say, you know, people have had these misconceptions for years, you know, and you would have thought, because you've obviously got the added thing of social media now as well. You know, if somebody's in your area doing a bad job, and then they get found out very quickly. So to still have all the misconceptions is quite worrying, really. Because obviously, like you say, we are you know, good tradespeople, and we want that message, you know, to get through.
It's worth noting, of course, that during the pandemic, nearly a third of us have actually called upon a tradesperson. I myself have actually used people to actually sort out challenges with the roof, tiles being replaced, exterior painting and so on, and can't sort of sing praises highly enough. So, I mean, part of the 85% who actually would say that, you know, there are positive experiences actually out there, and indeed actually 13% saying that their expectations were exceeded. So maybe, as I say, we also need to start emphasising the positives about these kind of things, Chris.
Definitely. I'm all for positivity. You hire someone, they do a good job, put the word out, spread the word out how good they were. It takes 2 minutes of your time and it might lead on to several jobs for the tradesperson you've had in your house. So use Twitter, email, Facebook. Put the word out there. Let's get behind our tradespeople. Respect your trades and big them up. You know, let's get some positivity back into the building industry.
But it also ties in very neatly when we start talking about social media to the hashtag, which is hashtag respect your trades. From your own point of view, Julian, is this something which has been long overdue?
Oh, definitely. It's a very good thing that, like I say, it's just more awareness now, you know, about stuff. And it just get it out there and respect people and tradespeople. Yeah, definitely.
And I got to ask the question actually to both of you. Have you ever had an experience where you thought, well, I feel completely ripped off by that?
No, we've been very lucky. The people that we use, like I say, all through word of mouth, you know, I've got a decent plumber, a decent electrician. I'm very lucky not to have had that experience myself personally.
Yeah, I have once with a car, but that was a different story.
Yeah, let's not go down the line of actually trying to have hashtag respect your car dealers. We'll be doing all sorts of things from that point of view. Step away from that. So where would you actually suggest people should actually go to find out further information about this campaign and also, say, the survey itself?
Checkatrade.com. All the information is online.
And again, with respect to obviously the kind of social media, presumably it's a case of the Instagrams, the Twitters, the tweets, the rest of the sort of stuff, etc. It is actually important that when you generate the stuff, that remember to actually thank your tradespeople and actually make sure that they get that acknowledgement, because I think, as you've said, word of mouth can be the strongest reputation builder and indeed recruiter for the industry.
Definitely. If they've done a good job, pat them on the back, send them on their way, and let your neighbours know about it. Do you know what I mean? We're all looking for someone who's reliable and does exactly what they say they can do. And let's spread the word and get them out there. The builder is going to keep the economy going. Let's support them. Let's get them. Let's keep them busy. That's what I'm trying to say. Keep the builder busy.
Absolutely, and I might actually go through the whole interview without actually singing the Checker Trade jingle, but I think I'll avoid that because it's just not good for that. But huge thanks to both of you today. It's been fascinating getting a little insight in terms of the industry itself. Julian Perryman and Chris Frediani, huge thanks. Take care and happy building, gentlemen.
Thank you, no problem.
Thank you very much for having us.
Well, where would we be without the laptop in the third decade of the 21st century? Probably having all manner of challenges in all sorts of ways. New research from ASUS has actually found that home workers actually start much earlier than when they were in the office. And astoundingly, and this certainly shocked a number of my colleagues at the University of Lincoln, 1 in 3 of them are so busy that they carry on working when they go to the loo. Now, to address this, who better than that ace psychologist? She can certainly sort of shed some light on this quite unusual behavior. It's the awesomely talented Dr. Becky Spellman. How are you, Becky?
I'm good. How are you?
Very good, and always a delight to touch base with your good self. But this particular survey, I must admit, I thought, surely, I mean, what about the dangers of a webcam in the bathroom? That could be potentially a disaster.
Yeah, you have to be really careful. And there's been some funny stories I've seen in the media of like people sharing too much, and everything from naked spouses to all sorts where accidents happened with the oversharing. But it was very interesting that 35% of people in your area in the East Midlands that actually work while on the loo. And I've often kind of done an email while I'm sort of going in that direction. And that level of multitasking is like right up my street, because I've been working from home for many years now, quite a long time. So I thought I was the only one. So this research by ASUS, which is the maker of the ZenBook, which is a multi-screen laptop, two-screen laptop, they actually, when they did this research, it was kind of full of confessions. And I think it was really reassuring for people, because they could read through this research and think, oh, I'm not the only one. I'm not the only one who's doing these kind of funny behaviors while trying to multitask while working from home.
The strength in numbers. I mean, clearly, Becky, you're a pioneer in this whole field, and it's becoming almost the new normal now. I mean, I can understand browsing social media, paying bills, life admin, watching a TV show. Okay, you can go with that. Texting, that would be fairly straightforward. But in terms of the multitasking aspect, I mean, I always was under the impression that as a male, I can't multitask. It's only women like yourself who can actually multitask. So are we seeing a split in the genders here as well?
Well, do you multitask while you're working?
Well, I suppose, if I'm pushed, probably the likelihood is that I have actually been in online meetings whilst at the same time as actually being on the online meeting, I've also been sorting out various student queries as well. So, yeah, on that basis, yeah, you could say yes.
Yeah, you're also a multitasker. I mean, it's hard for us to pay. You know, we can't pay full attention to two different things at once. So, multitasking can only kind of work if one task is really automated and something you don't even have to think about, like doing the ironing, and if it's not going to interrupt your work at all. And the watching the TV thing, I kind of think, oh, those people must really not like their job. They're like sneaking off to watch something while working hours.
Certainly we hear a great deal, of course, about the work-life balance. And I think one of the positives, actually, of the pandemic scenario is that, despite the fact that we were all immediately told, get back to work, no, get back home, no, go back to work again, which is obviously quite confusing and indeed it's quite stressful, really. I mean, this is surely something whereby handled appropriately and not allowing your work to dominate everything, so that literally from every waking moment you're kind of logging on and sorting things through from that point of view, it could actually be really quite healthy for both ourselves and, of course, the planet in terms of the lack of pollution caused by excessive commuting.
Yeah, I mean, I love not commuting because I think I get more done and I'm really into doing stuff, you know, I'm into checking off the to-do list, but balance is everything. And like, as a psychologist, I really know a lot about happiness and fighting off mood problems like depression. And people have to be, in this day and age, people have to be so much more careful about their schedule because there's less variety. So balance just is worse. If we spend more time in the home and we're not going out, we're really not just naturally getting that balance. So scheduling is pretty important for people now because a lot of people are going to be at risk of depression who might not have been at risk of it before.
And interesting enough, we still see those classic lines that 36% start work before they brush their teeth, another third before they've gotten out of their pyjamas. I don't know, Becky, I've never quite managed to get my head around that. I think if you are actually in a work mode, even if you're doing a Zoom mode, even if it's a Zoom without camera, as we're doing in this particular instance, you should really have, you know, you should actually be wearing clothes, I think, and wearing clothes actually mean business. It's just a thought.
Yeah, it's, you know, people have, it's like driving, people get into like bad habits, and definitely as working from home, people quite easily get into bad habits. And it's either the case that they are just overloaded and they're under so much pressure that there is no time and they feel like they're cutting corners by not doing these basic kind of personal hygiene needs in the morning and like getting set up and feeling kind of ready to go. Because definitely having that just taking care of yourself really gives you that feeling of, okay, I'm ready to go now. But it might just be bad habits as well, where people have just kind of said, oh, I don't really need to, like, because I'm working from home, I don't need to, I'll do that later. But yeah, actually setting it out like as if it is your office and turning up to your new office like you would. And, you know, you don't necessarily have to be all suited up if no one's going to see you, but actually just, yeah, having a shower, getting dressed. Stephanie helps people feel different about starting their working day.
Yeah, I think probably my only kind of acknowledgement of that, Becky, over the last few months was I haven't worn a tie. In fact, the first time yesterday when I was back on campus was the first time I actually wore a tie since March. I don't know if that's, does that mark me out as a radical, or is that just a case of, well, you know, it's okay. You can work from home without wearing a tie.
How did it feel putting on the tie?
Do you know, in some ways, almost as though it had never actually been away, really. It's kind of like one of those formats. Yeah. I mean, maybe it's just, again, the odd notion, but it's a slight unusual thing, as I thought, can I still remember after 6 months how to actually tie the Windsor knot? Yes, you could. So great. You
know. I love wearing like proper work clothes. Like, you know, I feel really smart and stuff. And it's kind of a novelty because I don't wear them. I don't have to wear them every day. So I think it's kind of nice because it's part of, you know, looking the part and feeling kind of good about yourself when you take pride in your appearance. So, but it's also nice to have the other side of things where we can be a bit more casual, and it's all about variety, isn't it?
Yeah. So, Becky, what are your top tips for being most productive whilst working from home? If I was to actually say, give me three top Becky Spellman tips, what would they be?
Well, number one, have your rules and boundaries, things you do and don't do. So that, you know, so that might be having a shower before, you know, starting your work, but whatever it is for you, you know what you want in your life, you know how you want to structure it. So set those rules, set your intentions, set goals as well, so that you actually know what you want to focus on, because it's so easy to just drift and spend time on tasks that aren't really that important. And just look after your work-life balance, make sure that you've got enjoyment, you've got achievement, you've got social contact, and you've got a bit of exercise.
And again, looking at the breakdown of this particular ACES survey, it's interesting in terms of where the average home worker actually has tabs and documents open during the workday. It's very much a case of the millennials, I think, lead, and the 55 to 64 year olds, only 5 tabs. Is that just a case of it's greater focus on that sort of bit routine as opposed to a scattergun approach?
Yeah, it's really interesting. You know, the millennial behavior is so different to the older generation. I think definitely the younger generation has, their attention span is so much less, and it's understandable that they would hold more tabs open because they've practiced in diverting their attention very quickly and going back to things and going to and fro. Whereas, yeah, older people having less tabs makes perfect sense because they're working at a slower pace, their attention span is longer. And yeah, we definitely see those generation differences and have seen this in this ACES survey.
And presumably there's always the line, if you're talking about computing, when artificial intelligence looks after the whole system, then we'll have AIs and conceivably, I say, avatar versions of yourself, Becky, actually just popping up to actually say, it's time you did this now.
Innovation is amazing, and that's happened really quickly because of what's happened, you know. And that's, I think, the amazing things about humans is how creative and how innovative we can be. And tech has certainly caught up very quickly due to what's happened, which is amazing. It's created a lot of opportunities, and it's made life a lot simpler for us.
And where, Becky, would you point people to find out further information about this particular survey?
So for more information about ASUS, which is the maker of the ZenBook 2 screen laptop, go to ASUS, ASUS.com.
And I'd also actually put in a plug for the privatetherapyclinic.co.uk to find out more details about the awesomely talented Becky Spellman, because it's a great website and well worth accessing as well. There we are, a little shameless cross promotion there for you, Becky.
Oh, two final questions.
Two final questions. Have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the programme today?
Oh, it was fantastic.
Well then, can we look forward to connecting with you again in the not-too-distant future? Will you return?
I really hope so.
Fantastic. Dr. Becky Spellman, many thanks indeed. Take care and happy commuting and home working.
Thank you so much. Speak soon.
Well, it does seem as though humanity sometimes just doesn't manage to get the whole thing in terms of actually coping with the confusion of COVID and various other bits and pieces. New research from Santander has found that half of British folk have indeed admitted to struggling to keep track of new investment scam schemes. Yes, the scammers are indeed out there. So as a response, we have certainly brought in the A-team when it comes to poetic scammers. We have two fabulous folk to actually share with us their own ways of actually using fraudsters' own words to actually raise awareness of this. First of all, the awesomely talented poet extraordinaire, it's Pam Ayres. How are you, Pam?
Well, I'm very flattered. Thank you, Alex.
Well, delighted to have you on board, Pam. And then, as if it wasn't getting any better, we've also got ace performance poet Sully Briggs with us. How are you, Sully?
Hey, bro. I'm good, man. I'm great. Thank
Fantastic.
You,
and indeed, from Santander, the wonderful Dan Standish. How are you, Dan?
Hi, Alex. Good, thank you.
Dan, we'll turn to you first, because this is one of those areas where it almost seems to be a weekly thing where we hear of scams and various other factors coming through this. Is it just a case of, I don't know, what's going on? It's as though the whole world is being summed up by the presidential debate in the United States at present.
Well, no, not necessarily. I think that the key thing to call out is what you've stated there. So our research also shows that, you know, three quarters of people are worried about falling victim to investment scams. Now, just quickly, an investment scam is where criminals create fake investment opportunities to lure their victims in. Now, these can be in things like gold or palm oil or emerging technologies, and they will always offer high returns. They'll promise these guaranteed rates, and they always downplay the risks, and they also pressurize you into parting with your money. Now, it's very, very sophisticated. The criminals are moving online by creating very legitimate and professional looking websites. Now, what the criminals are also very good at is making you feel safe and secure by using manipulative language and, again, making you feel confident in sending them your money. So that's why at Santander, ahead of World Poetry Day, we've partnered with Pam Ayres and Sully Briggs, and we've asked them to incorporate within their poems the same words and the types of techniques the criminals are using to convince their victims. And it's been a fantastic result. And, you know, if anyone wants to see those poems, please go to the Santander UK YouTube channel, and you can see the full videos and you can hear what these two fantastic poets have said.
Well, as I said, it's the dream team in many ways, Ayres and Briggs from that point of view. Absolutely amazing. Pam, let's come to you first. When you were approached with this particular aspect of using the fraudster's own language, obviously ahead of National Poetry, did you say, yes, I'm in?
Yes, I did, Alex, because I am angered by the fact that particularly older people are targeted, people who've got a pension pot, by these clever people, and they're tricked out of their money. And then there's also this terrible sense of shame that you fell for it, that you didn't spot it. And so it's so harmful in every way. So I was very pleased to join with Santander to try and get the message across. And also, as a writer, it was an interesting project to try and distill the mountains of information they sent me down into a poem that bounced along and got the message across. So it was quite a challenge to my poetic abilities.
I'm sure one that you rose to effortlessly, Pam. Effortlessly.
Thanks.
Sully, from your own perspective, I mean, we have progressed somewhat since the days where we used to get emails from people in Nigeria who claimed to actually be good friends of us and then said, can you please actually send your details here? Sully, from your own point of view, what were your thoughts on this whole sort of project?
I thought it was interesting as well, Alex, just because I've had friends who've been victims of fraud and scams, and I've had my own personal experience. I think particularly in this generation where we're being more inclined to be entrepreneurial and take risks with our money and try out new opportunities, it makes us increasingly more exposed to things of this nature. So for me, it was an interesting way to kind of address the issue with my peers in a way that didn't feel kind of too intimidating or too kind of like aggressive, you know. So it was a great opportunity for me to explore that, and I don't think I'd explored it in the past. And like Pam was kind of saying, there is that embarrassment of having fallen for something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, we shouldn't be embarrassed. We should just be cautious and ensure that things don't happen again or at all. Pam, can you give us a little tease of some of the lyrics that you've actually put together in terms of the project?
Absolutely. A tease coming up. I would just say to people, use Scam Smart, which is a tool which has been created by the FCA to, if you're interested in investing online, check it on Scam Smart, because that will tell you whether there are risks attached. Here is a little snippet of my poem. Have you got some money? Are you getting on like me? Are you heading for retirement to be in wild and free? Are you looking for investments? Somewhere canny for your cash. Well, be careful. There are fraudsters who will steal it in a flash. They are thieving people's savings, taking everything they've got, especially the older folk who've got a pension pot. They do not stalk the foolish. No, that isn't what they do. They target able, well-researched investors, just like you. That's superb. A little snippet.
Absolutely superb. Yeah, that's one of the reasons, Pam, why I regularly say to my colleagues at the University of Lincoln, Caroline Duffy, she's okay, but she's no Pam Ayres. That's the bottom line. You know, that's our official line.
Well, thank you very much for that that compliment.
And equally, Sully, we need to ask for a little snippet from your good self. Surely, off you go, sir.
Oh, pressure. Tough act to follow, man. So I'll give you a little piece. It's called If It's Too Good to Be True. You see, investment scams ain't as simple as something you dismiss in a pop-up window. It's a voice that sounds professional, a tone that's mildly personal, a well-presented, well-edited article, a picture of someone recognizable, combined with words that pull the trigger on a response that's emotional. And that's how they find their target. It's big deals, fast cars, sprinkled with images of hotels with infinity pools. Make so-and-so per month. Your favorite influencer did it, so why can't you? So you start to think about owning your own property, your parents' life insurance policy, covering your tuition or maybe nursery fees. And all you need to do is make a small investment into a brand new and exciting cryptocurrency. It's not always logical. It's not always promotional. Investment scams is not a random act. Fraud is a carefully calculated, premeditated operation, which surgically removes your experience and rationale from the conversation.
Genius. I mean, I can sense the spirit of Benjamin Zephaniah saying, It's just awesome. Dan, final questions from yourself. Where can people go to find out more details about Santander's scam sonnets?
Thanks, Alex. So again, please go to the Santander UK YouTube channel. Again, you can listen to the full versions of those two amazing poems. I would also strongly suggest that people who are considering investments or want some more educational content around scams, you know, you don't have to be a Santander customer. Go to your own bank's website. Make sure you search for fraud and top tips and scam advice. There's lots of information available. And please also make sure that you visit santanderevents.co.uk. We're hosting 30-minute scam awareness sessions that are online. They're free to everyone, and again, we'll be raising the risks and the concerns that everyone should be looking out for.
Ace poet Pam Ayres, also ace poet and performance poet Sully Breaks, and of course Dan Standish, who possibly doesn't do much poetry, but I'm sure he could learn a lot from both yourself and Sully. Huge thanks,
Alex.
Many thanks. Keep on keeping on. Bye for now.
Thanks,
bye
Alex.
For now.